leader Uruba bin Wahad, Jamil's wife Karima Alameen, Imam Talib Abdul Rashid, the fiery Pan Africa, and Impact Repertory Theater at the Martin Luther King Labor Center, 210 West 43rd Street, New York City. Admission is free. For more information, call 212-330-8029. Let's join together and free Imam Jamil Alameen. This is Mumia Abu Jamal.
Come, join us for the 13th Annual Vigil for International Peace and Ecology on Sunday, September 21, from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. A celebration of live music and dance performances, spoken word, a human peace sign, art installations, and a World Peace Flag ceremony that celebrates the United Nations International Day of Peace. That's Sunday, September 21, from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Central Park, Nuremberg Bandshell, by the Bethesda Fountain. For more information or volunteer, go to www.vigil4internationalpeace.org. That's the number 4 in the URL. Or call 212-222-5432. That's 212-222-5432. We'll see you there. Don't you know it's here?
The WBAI Community Advisory Board wants to hear from you what you think about the current state of programming at WBAI. Please tell us what you like, what you do not like, and more importantly, what do you think we need to do? Any suggestions are welcome. Please send your comments to the WBAI Community Advisory Board, WBAI Radio 388, Atlantic Avenue, 3rd floor, Brooklyn, New York. The zip code is 11217. Again, send your comments to the WBAI Community Advisory Board, 388 Atlantic Avenue, 3rd floor, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. Thanks for your ideas and invaluable support.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York. It's 7 o'clock. Time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. Oh, they live on for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood.
Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Mike.
Good evening. Happy Wednesday.
Thank you. Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Kyle.
Hola.
And Bernie S.
Greetings from Pennsylvania.
Well, today was an interesting day. I don't know if you've tried to get to certain websites, but you might have had some difficulty. You might have had some little spinning dials that didn't quite resolve. Actually, they did resolve. What I expected to find when I heard about this is part of the fight for the future, net neutrality, all that. I heard that Netflix was going to have simply a spinning wheel on the front page, and I figured, wow, that's really big. big of them to simply cut off all of their customers and not give them any of the content they paid for. But no, in actuality, they have the spinning wheel just sort of on the side. And that's part of a public outcry against the U.S. cable company's attempted power grab. It's called the spinning wheel of death. And from this article in The Guardian, explains, we all hate it. But you may be seeing a lot of it on the internet today, and that's because today is the internet slowdown. Have we been participating in the internet slowdown? Anyone? Yes, obviously you have. Okay.
I'm just going to speak very slowly today.
I haven't really been on the internet that much today, so I haven't had a chance to enjoy the slowdown. But the point is that the internet will get slow if the net neutrality debate is lost. And basically companies will be able to put you on a crowded highway instead of the fast superhighway, unless you pay more. If you pay more, hey, everything's okay. And if you don't cross them in any way, if you don't go to sites they don't like, things will go smoothly for you. So, I don't know.
Just to be clear, it's not you, the consumer, who can pay more. That would be, you know, one thing. But it's going to be differentiation amongst different content providers or websites you might want to visit, some of which don't like to think of themselves as content providers.
And it creates a class system with the nature of routing on the internet, which gives priority to other people. And it sort of breaks the whole way that routing was set up originally when the internet was first getting started.
Emmanuel.
Yes, go ahead, Barney.
It reminds me of the book 1984 by George. Animal Farm by George Orwell, where the dictatorial pigs were saying that all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others.
Yes.
Because this is what this amounts to here. All the traffic will be routed equally, except some will be routed more equally than others. In other words, the others get slowed down.
Four legs good, two legs better.
That's right.
All right.
And if they really truly want that, why don't they just get some of their own networks and build something on top or parallel to the existing network and not disrupt the freedom and free routing of people that enjoy the public internet as it is?
Well, go ahead, Rob.
Well, and to be sure, this they want to charge. Basically, they want to double dip. They want to charge the publishers of content when the recipients of the content are already paying for their internet accounts, their internet access. So basically, the model that since the 20 years or so we've had the internet in public mainstream use, the people have paid for their net connections and therefore have been able to access the net. That's it. In general, you were able to access what you wanted without anyone getting in between you. But they want to charge the people who are publishing individual sites, who are using, who are basically making the net interesting to use in the first place. Some of us don't feel like we should have to accede to that double dipping.
And this is an extension of a lot of encroachments on the concept of bandwidth and internet being like a utility. You've seen this in a lot of ways with wireless it's a little different, but tiering of data packages and sort of walled garden, the slow freeing up of data on a handset. It took quite a while. I remember when they had like media nets and different things on the early GPRS enabled handsets. Also just tiering and what was the other thing I was thinking of? It'll come back to me, but just this concept of not getting just this free open internet, but perhaps I would say limiting and throttling of certain sites, or limiting and creating sort of we see it like sites being forbidden, you know, firewall rules, these kinds of things. They give you a certain kind of the internet, as opposed to what Rob was saying, which is like a free and open, utility, as it were.
Rob, I think you might have just slightly misspoken, and I think you know this, but maybe some of our listeners might not, that the people who make websites already pay to be on the internet. Maybe that's fair. You pay to be on the internet, they pay to be on the internet, so you can be connected to. But what a lot of the large ISPs want is that the major content provider should not just pay their ISPs, but should pay your ISP as well. And that's what's really kind of perverse about all this. And to Kyle's earlier point that maybe they should just build a sort of separate network, that's what the cable companies want to do. They want to choose what should be on the internet and what should be hard to get to on the internet and what should not be on the internet. And, you know, maybe in some parallel universe where there was competition and you could choose between cable company A that gave you the whole internet and cable company B that gave you part of the internet, that might be okay. But we don't have that in the United States. Most people have at most one or two choices for broadband in their home. And those choices all want to slow down the internet for websites that don't pay their bribes. And so it's not like you can, you know, choose. So if you want to be a telco and you want to be a monopoly, then my view is that you should be regulated like a monopoly and have common carrier status, as it's called. And there's all these like crazy legal terms. But in my view, and in the view of a lot of the people, if you want to be the only game in town, you have to be the fair game in town. And I think that's totally reasonable.
Emmanuel.
Yes, go ahead, Barney.
This protection racket, as Mike was just alluding to, that the internet service providers are trying to get legalized. So they would say, hey, that's a nice content site you have there. It'd be a shame if we were to slow down and your users wouldn't be able to use your services. If anybody believes that charging, that the ISPs charging these content providers fees to handle the traffic isn't going to get passed down to consumers, they're deluding themselves. And if any politicians say this isn't going to increase your cost, they are lying to you, because it's going to get passed down to the consumer. It always does.
And to say that you're slowing down connections that are already, from a world like global perspective, pretty darn slow to start with, is hilarious. I mean, it's laughable. And what I meant really with building their own networks, I mean, they already co-locate. I know Netflix. I know I've read an article. They already locate servers for caching and other things away from their locations and closer to like points of presence for like major communities where a broadband might distribute from a backbone. They're already doing that for efficiency's sake, I'm sure. And it just seems like, well, if they care so much and it's so advantageous to them, why don't they lease their own lines and do that stuff separately, but without disrupting and as Rob and you guys have said, like protecting the internet. I mean, clearly the government does that. They have their own parallel connections and they don't disrupt or, well, they're capable of running their own equipment. And their meddling is kept to purely recreational purposes. When their stuff is concerned, they provide their own equipment. And I really feel like it's an encroachment on the public internet, as we've been saying.
Yeah, and you mentioned bringing the sort of routing toward the shortest point between two points, as that's a basic factor of how the internet's put together. On a technical level, the internet was built from the ground up to route around damage, to route the most efficient way possible. So the internet is basically already, as it is, with network neutrality not being violated, the internet is already going to get you what you want in the fastest way possible. That's just how it works.
It's a little more complicated than that, but we should be clear that network neutrality is already a thing that we don't have in some circumstances. Netflix has already started paying the bribes to some of the largest ISPs because they want to get their movies to people. And that's cool. Netflix has a business model that maybe allows them to do that, or maybe allows them to take a loss for a couple months. They would rather not be paying this money, as they've said, but they can afford it. Other people can't afford these fees and will be forced to pay them if the large telcos have their way. And level three, which is a large sort of connector of networks, has published some blog posts showing that the cable companies are deliberately slowing down the sort of interconnections that they have between level three and, well, they don't name names, but it's Comcast, to force people like Netflix to pay these bribes. So it's already happening. So the people who say, oh, they would never go after Netflix, Netflix was literally the first one they went after.
Well, how are
and
they
more
doing
are coming.
How exactly are they doing? If this isn't in place yet, how are they telling Netflix, you have to pay us to get this traffic to go faster?
So there's nothing in place. What we want to have is we want to have regulation in place that says you must maintain a neutral network. So what, again, no names have been named, but it's Comcast and Time Warner. They are refusing to upgrade the switching equipment between them and Level 3 and many other large, large business ISPs so that the data can go through fast enough.
Unless a bribe is paid. But what I'm curious about is how do they phrase that? How do they say, oh, we can fix this if you just pay us now?
So they don't fix it that way. They say they don't upgrade the core network that the public can use. And what they do is they say, hey, Netflix, you know, that switch, it's kind of slow. Wouldn't you rather be on our side of the switch so that you don't have to go through it? And that's what they do. And they've already started getting away with it, and we must stop them.
So basically, we're already at a stage where they can get away with this.
They are getting away with it.
Okay, so what we're advocating for then is for more regulation so that they can't get away with what they currently get away with, let alone the future where they want to get away with even more. You're saying it's bad enough as it is right now for them to be subjected to further restrictions.
Yes. I'm saying that they should be, if they want to be a public utility, they should be regulated like one. If they don't want to be a public utility, then they should have competition. They can't have it both ways, in my view.
And cable companies are not considered public utilities.
It's super complicated. If I try and tell you the details off the top of my head, I'm going to get them wrong. But they are claiming to be in this, like, there's a telecommunications provider and an information service provider, and they're regulated very differently, and they're claiming to be whichever one gives them the most advantage on any given day.
Well, now, is Verizon a phone company? Are they subject to the same rules and regulations?
No. Verizon Internet is not subject to the same rules and regulations as Verizon Landlines.
Oh, that's how they get around it. Okay, yeah. So they basically do the old source interlink thing of splitting into two companies. Okay,
Michael Powell was the guy who did that.
Uh-huh. Yes, Michael Powell, our good friend Michael Powell. Yeah, tell us some of the history of Mike there.
Well, back during the General Colin Powell. I got to get the rank right. General Colin Powell's son, Michael Powell. You know, a little nepotism. George W. Bush hired him to be appointed him to be a commissioner of the FCC back a few administrations ago. And he pushed and had things changed so that cable companies Internet service providers were no longer, Mike can probably help clarify this for me, were no longer going to be regulated like common carriers. And ever since, we've seen this slippery slope into what we all feared, and it's getting worse. It's getting real.
Look at how much they're willing to spend fighting these things instead of upgrading the network so that everything can just be routed and switched over in a really balanced way to begin with, and the infrastructure is such that it can allow all of these things to transit in the most efficient way possible, the way it ought to be set up. They want to just sit on these existing connections and weasel one way or another to get these media companies that are like, you know, hot web 2.0 companies to pay them off, and then they'll probably not upgrade after that anyway. They'll get their way, and then it'll still be slow. We'll still be paying through the nose, and they'll be extorting money out of these media companies that want better networks anyway and want to deliver content and stuff over to your handset or whatever, and we're just going to continue to sort of flounder in this without stepping outside of it and without building and running and demanding better infrastructure and infrastructure outside of this context. And it's really kind of sad to see, because there's so much that's possible and so much we could build that we've seen run really well, and I'd be really sad if people didn't see through some of these tactics.
Well, to wrap this up, from the Guardian article, net neutrality is about free speech and preventing powerful interests from discriminating against, censoring, slowing down, and blocking content on the Internet. And hopefully the unstoppable momentum of today's Internet slowdown is just a reflection of public outcry that has been simmering since the FCC first announced its proposal to allow for a tiered, i.e. divided, Internet. We've bombarded them with petitions, camped out in tents on their doorstep, and of course, John Oliver crashed their website. That was one of the proudest moments. It's been widely reported and I've heard this before, that more than 99% of the comments that the FCC has gotten so far broadly support net neutrality. Now, if the FCC chooses to move ahead with a proposal that benefits cable executives while undermining public interest, then public comment periods are meaningless, and the FCC exposes itself as an agency that has no legitimacy, or verifies that theory amongst some of us. So basically, today is a statement. Today is something that kind of measures the outcry that already is out there. What happens tomorrow? What do we do?
I don't know. I've got a small update. Fight for the Future, who has arranged today's day of protest on battleforthenet.com. They sent out an email a few hours ago that says the slowdown is working like magic. At some points, we had more than 1,000 phone calls going per minute to Congress, and the White House and the sheer volume of comments has crashed the FCC submission system once again, which is fun.
So slow down the internet and crash systems. We sound like one of those groups, but.
Capiche?
Yeah. But the point is, where do we go from here? We need a plan. We need to know, okay, we've done this. We've indicated that there's strength in numbers. Do we keep commenting on the FCC site? There's got to be a clear plan of action, and that's something that has always been. Obviously, go to EFF.org and see what those guys are saying, because they tend to win a lot of cases when they actually go to court and challenge things. But the rest of us need to know what we can do, because, yeah, there's strength in numbers.
It might be a little disheartening, because it seems like we keep fighting this very battle time and again. We did it with the SOPA PIPA days. We're doing it with this. And I think the best we can hope for is that people stay angry about it. You know, so many causes come and go and, you know, are a big deal one day and forgotten the next. And the best we can do, because even if we defeat this time, it's just going to come back again in some other guise at some point in the near future. Because those who want net neutrality to die its final death are the ones with lots of money and lots of time and lots of people working on it. So the best we can do is also be lots of people working on it, and stay aware, stay angry about it, and stay focused on what's important to not let happen.
I also think we shouldn't pay for things that don't have our interests at all in mind, and maybe build some of our own things that are perhaps better instead of paying for them.
All right, that sounds like a good note to end on. Build our own things and communicate and talk to other people and hopefully share stories and things like that. And it's kind of a good lead in to something that we want to remind people about. Coming up in just over a week is, anybody want to guess? You know already. No?
The equinox?
Maybe that's possible, but no, that's not what I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of Maker Faire. Maker Faire is happening again in spring, in Queens, in the fall. And we have a call for volunteers. If you want to attend Maker Faire and actually get in for free, you can volunteer and learn a lot, teach a lot. Maker Faire is something that we try to attend every year when it comes to New York, because it's just a great way to meet new people and see all kinds of cool things that are being invented by individuals, by kids, all kinds of people that that appreciate the kinds of things we're talking about. So that happens at the Hall of Science in Queens, New York Hall of Science. That's right on the 7 train by the World's Fair. And if you go to tinyurl.com/makerfaire-volunteer, and you spell Maker Faire, MakerFaire-volunteer, all the information on how you can volunteer is there. And I'm told that they need people that know how to solder. So I guess Mitch Altman is somewhere else in the planet right now. Otherwise, they would have all the knowledge they could possibly need. But if you know how to solder, there is definitely a use for your skills at Maker Faire. It's coming up not this weekend, coming up, but the one after that. And of course, more information you can find at the Maker Faire site. Which, did I write that down? I think it's makerfaire.com, without a dash.
I believe Mitch is not attending because of Maker Faire's affiliation with DARPA, which we've discussed in the past. But even when he does attend, he can do the work of more than one person. But Maker Faire is on such a scale that it takes more than him to
It really, and it gets bigger every year. That space is huge, it's just incredible how it gets filled up. But it really is, it's a very healthy, positive environment. That's why I always encourage people to go to that. Coming up, Maker Faire, and we'll have probably a ticket giveaway next week on the show, as we do every year, maybe an interview with somebody at Maker Faire in general. Bernie, are you going to come up this year?
I'm going to try. I missed it last year, but I was there the year before. It's always a lot of fun. It's just like a great big park. Is it still going to be held at the old World's Fair grounds?
Yes. Not actually the World's Fair grounds. That's across on the other side of the parkway, but the Hall of Science is a huge area. You get to it very easily on the number 7 train or by car, too, if you're driving in from someplace else. All the info is on their website, but, it's same place.
Like it. Lots of grass and trees and tents, and it's very festive and very techy, and you'll be with a lot of kindred spirits.
Yeah. It's really, they take over the entire, including lots and some of the grassy fields. It's huge. There's tons of different villages for different things, like robotics competitions and different things like a hackerspace kind of area or like a making village with soldering and all of that, as well as like concessions, tons of great food and entertainment, different groups doing exhibitions and shows and as well as vendors and workshops, people teaching things and kind of demoing new stuff, and of course there are sponsors and other people represented with kind of funky displays and a lot of eye-catching, really interesting stuff. So it's definitely worthwhile.
Actually, I just found this on the website. There's that soldering thing. It's called Learn to Solder. It's the Learn to Solder booth. So if you look that up and fill out the form, they say Learn to Solder activity is one of the most popular at Maker Faire, soldering newbies and experienced solderers alike of all ages. And I mean all ages. We're talking 5-year-old soldering. It's kind of a scary sight. They can put together their very own blinky LED rocket pin. And if you've been to Maker Faire, you know this tent is rocking all weekend long. Yes. And I see from this form that you'll actually get paid minimum wage if you volunteer there. So in addition to getting in, you'll actually get paid for your efforts. So if that's something you're interested in, if you know how to solder, then search for that on the Maker Faire site. Go ahead, Rob.
Something about Maker Faire, people might not know, it's an all-ages event, as you said. It's a very all-ages event. It is great for kids. If you've got children of your own, if you have access to children that are not your own, bring them to Maker Faire because they'll love it. You'll have a great time. And
wait a minute, what did you just advocate there?
Matching children.
Okay, fine.
Absolutely. Bring kids to this because there is no better time to get a kid actually interested in maker subjects, hacker subjects, all this cool stuff that you could do with technology and inventiveness and creativity. The Hall of Science is a great place on its own for that, but Maker Faire is just all the more awesome. And
that is the thing. You've touched upon something because in all the ones I've been to, and I don't know how many there have been, is it, what, 5 now?
Something like that.
You see kids running around just having the time of their lives and playing with all kinds of gizmos and working on inventions as well. And in all that time, I've seen one kid crying. Crowds of kids, you'd expect more than that, but no, only one. And I'm not sure he was even in the right place. He might have been on his way someplace else.
So that's a very good point.
Yeah, so makerfaire.com, check it out there, and we might be there with the van. We're not sure, but regardless of whether or not we're there, you can be there, and hopefully we'll have ticket giveaways next week, and you can help people solder and volunteer in other ways as well. Okay, back to breaking news of a sort. What's this I'm reading? For some reason, this story is Dateline Moscow. Nearly 5 million Gmail passwords leaked. 5 million, guys? Really? Hackers have, right away, this story goes off on the wrong foot. Why are they hackers? Why are they always hackers when passwords get leaked? If they're leaked, anybody can get them. It's not hard to guess a password, if that's what's going on here. It's not hard to trade a file with passwords in it. But let's look at the story and hold our noses when the H word is used to describe. Go ahead.
Just replace it with, like, Bridge Club members.
I'd rather read it the way it's written so that people can experience the full stench of it.
Okay.
Hackers have stolen and published a database containing the logins and passwords of nearly 5 million Google accounts. Russian technology news source CNews.ru reported, and that's what the Moscow dateline there. Now, according to information provided by a user of the Bitcoin Security Online Forum, where the database was published, over 60% of the accounts corresponding to those logins can be accessed successfully. The database contains 4.93 million Google accounts from English, Russian, and Spanish users. This news comes just a couple of days after it came to light that over 4.6 million mail.ru accounts and over 1.25 million Yandex email boxes have also been compromised. Their information was also published on the Bitcoin Security Forum. The two Russian companies have said that the databases containing the compromised email accounts comprised mostly inactive and hacked accounts, which had been collected over a long period of time via phishing and Trojan horses. The internal security systems of the companies were not compromised, they said. With nearly 11 million email logins and passwords now floating around on the web, email providers have suggested that their users choose strong passwords and enable two-step verification. Well, okay, we know two-step verification can be thwarted pretty easily. And apparently, people are just leaving accounts lying around. Does this really even count? If these are Gmail accounts that aren't being used in the first place or whatever other service, is it any different than somebody creating a million passwords, a million accounts on some free web server, free web email service, and using those? Is there really a story here?
Well, one difference between taking even an abandoned, inactive Gmail account and just creating a new one of your own is that abandoned one will have a contact list and possibly other information sitting in its mailboxes that would be of use to somebody looking to do shady things.
Yep. Okay. All right.
So people should change their passwords regularly, I guess. But I have... You know, we aim the show for a general audience, but we know that many of our listeners, you know, do work in the computer industry or the security industry or whatever. And I have a challenge to us, those of us who do that. We have to fix this password problem. We have to come up with something better than passwords, because this is just going to happen. It has been happening more and more often. It's going to continue to happen more and more often. And normal people like do not have the brain capacity. I do not have the brain capacity. Most people do not have the brain capacity to remember like 1,000 different passwords for 1,000 different sites that change every 2 months because their databases get leaked. So we have to come up with something better, and I don't know what it's going to be.
Well, if you have a good password, a database being leaked should not contain that password. It should be encrypted in some form.
Yeah, you're on some website that you think is well implemented and it turns out not to be, so that website, unbeknownst to you, has your password in the clear. And they have no security, so it got leaked. Now I have to change it on all the other sites. This is not something that normal people can do.
How about we just reveal the names of those sites that have no security whatsoever? I think that would be a good way.
And then what? It's too late by the time we find out.
But you don't use them anymore.
But it's too late, is my point.
It's too late for what? For your Yahoo account?
To stop using an account. A website after you learn that its security is
poor. Well, you're not using it anymore if it's been compromised. Someone else is using it in your name. But it's a good lesson to those people that are thinking of using it, not to trust those companies. It's also a good message for companies thinking of getting into this business that you have to have some level of security unless you want to be made a fool of. And I'm finding it hard to believe that there are companies out there where you could just simply get a database and you have all the passwords. I mean, a 12-year-old kid can set up a free BSD machine that has more security than that. And it's really not that difficult. And especially after all the time that we've been talking about this, it's unforgivable. So I don't think that's what happened with Gmail. I think in Gmail's case, they were easy to guess passwords, right?
Some of them are easy to guess passwords, and apparently some of them were taken from the user's computer with a keylogger or some other Trojan.
Well, the other thing to remember with all this is that sometimes people use the same password for all of their accounts, right? Their bank accounts, their email, whatever. So if you're good and you're targeting somebody, you can really take over their lives pretty easily if the users themselves use bad passwords. Now, we had CNN last week, of course, advising people if your password is password, you might want to change those S's to dollar signs and then you'll be more secure. Well, guess what? You're not that much more secure at all, especially after they said that. So there are all kinds of things that you can learn, all kinds of ways you can make yourself more secure by not using words, not using your birthday, not using your social security number, God forbid. One of the best I've seen is using a sentence that you can remember, and using, say, the first letter of each word of that sentence. Doesn't spell a word, but you can remember the sentence. And maybe you capitalize the second letter and not the third. Things like that, little things that only you would know. And when you get those questions, in case you forgot your password, you don't make it something like, what was my hometown when I grew up? It's pretty easy to figure that out. Or what is my name? You know, you can lie. You don't have to. What is your favorite color? You can say Mars. You know, no one's going to prosecute you for doing that. Do whatever you want. Just remember what it is you did. It's not difficult.
My favorite color actually is Mars. But having a strong password isn't the only thing. You could still get you could still lose the security of your password by other means. So it's not enough just to have a snazzy, innovative password. You have to change it regularly, because then if you end up in one of these databases, if you're name and password is being traded around on some forum, there's still the chance that you can change it to something else by the time somebody criminal wants to do something with it. So, yeah, get into the habit. Update your passwords every so often.
I mean, yeah, that's good advice, but it's people don't follow it, and we know people don't follow it, and we have to do something better in the long run.
Do you have any ideas, though?
I don't, unfortunately.
All right. Well, speaking of data breaches and bad security, Home Depot. Wow. You know, I've been hearing rumors about Home Depot now for several weeks. Why have I been hearing rumors about this? The story was only released this week. Basically, there have been all kinds of data breaches, apparently. Home Depot said customers who shopped at its stores as far back as April were exposed, meaning the breach extended for more than 4 months, including the busy summer season when we all go to Home Depot, far longer than the three-week Target breach. And you remember the fallout from that. People were resigning, all kinds of stock was falling, stuff like that. And get this, there's a guy in Illinois who is already suing them. Home improvement retailer Home Depot has been sued over the data breach by a customer, saying the company failed to properly safeguard customer data from hackers. Again, here we go, hackers.